And good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from Red River Radio and from the Knoll Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. We invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he has authored over 70 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife Julie and their two children live in East Texas. And Cliff, thank you so much for serving once again tonight, coming all the way up from Nacogdoches.
Happy to serve.
And we again invite you to call in tonight at 800-552-8502 to ask Cliff your question. And if you have a photograph of a bird or a bird sound that you would like to send us, you can email those to redriverradiomail@gmail.com. That's redriverradiomail@gmail.com. Cliff, at the end of last month's program, you gave us a conservation tip, and could you refresh our memories this week for our listeners?
That's right. The end of every episode, we end with a conservation tip, you know, something you can think about, go home and contemplate. It's not a demand, but just a tip, some advice. And the one that made it last episode was the wild hog, and I'm not talking about motorcycles. I'm talking about the four-legged critters that wreak havoc on the landscape. They tear up crops, they tear up bird habitat, they affect water quality. They're a big issue with vehicle collisions. I mean, there's really not a whole lot of good that hogs have, except if you like pork, which I do. They're tasty. So we need more people eating pork and harvesting them off the landscape, because they really are a problem with what they're doing. They're trampling, they're eating. They'll eat anything. So ground nesting birds are very vulnerable to wild hogs. If these hogs sniff up a nest with eggs, that's immediate protein, and they'll readily eat them up. So we need to get hogs off the landscape. They're not native. They were brought here somewhere about 400 years ago to North America. The wild boar has bred with the domestic pig and created what we have today, and they're a nuisance. So our message is to try to help eliminate them, which is going to be impossible to do, but at least try to keep the numbers down.
Keep the population in check.
Keep the population in check. That way they're competing with other species. They're eating acorns in the fall and winter that should be there for white-tailed deer and wild turkey. So there's just not a whole lot of good of a wild hog.
And technically, you could consider them one of the first really invasive species in the North American continent, that especially is a deleterious species.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but certainly so. And then, boy, it's been a landslide, especially of plants. Mm-hmm. We've really done a poor job a good job of bringing in bad plants that are poor for the environment. So people at Caddo Lake right now, they've heard their fill of giant salvinia.
Yeah.
And North Toledo Bend and many coves of Toledo Bend and elsewhere, that's an invasive, it's a non-native aquatic plant that's taking away our open water. And that's not good for recreation, it's not good for waterfowl. It's terrible. And then grasses and weeds, we brought in so many things that just take away from what's natural and what actually gives to wildlife. And that's a problem. So controlling invasives is really important. Yep.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502 with your questions about our avian world and birds in general. That's 800-552-8502. 8502. Cliff has brought a guest with him this week. Could you introduce our guest and let us know why she's here?
And we've never had an on-air guest, so she wins the prize for first ever. I'm really excited to have Kelly Bashaw with us today. She's a student at Stephen F. Austin State University. She's a biology major, and she's got a wildlife emphasis. And so the reason we brought her, well, one reason is she's taking a course called Forestry Techniques, right?
Wildlife Techniques.
Wildlife Techniques. Thank you. It's with Dr. Chris Comer at SFA. And each of those students have to find a professional and kind of shadow them. So Kelly's shadowing me today. And and I thought, well, how many students get to go on the radio? So we brought Kelly along so she could contribute, and we're going to ask her a couple questions here, mainly about what it's like to get a degree. She's a junior undergrad, and so I want to turn it over to Kelly and kind of tell us what it's like to go to school and get a degree in wildlife.
Well, it's really exciting, and I love getting to get so hands-on. I don't feel like a lot of degrees, I feel like you just go to class and you sit there and you learn, but with a wildlife degree, you really get to get in there with the animals and figure out what you'd actually be doing if you were a wildlife professional instead of just hearing about it.
Right, and this last week, last weekend you were telling me about some duck banding you got to do. So speaking of get your hands dirty, tell us about what you did and where you did it.
Well, it was a really great opportunity we had with Wildlife Society. We went to Louisiana at Crotts Springs, and we got to stay at a nice WMA there. They set us up real fancy. It was pretty awesome. And we basically woke up real early at like 4 in the morning. We had to get out there, and they set up some rocket nets. We were hanging out in the blinds, and then we got to go run as fast as you can as soon as you hear the rocket net go off and try to take as many blue-winged teals, what we were getting, out of the net as you can.
Cool.
And so then we got to take them out, and we got to put bands on them so we can mark them for future reference and take some blood samples as well as like swabbing for genetic stuff so we could see how they're doing with their avian flu and see kind of like how that was affecting the population or if it was a big problem or not.
Right. So you mentioned 4 a.m., so this degree is maybe not for everybody, right?
No, yeah. You have to be willing to get up and work hard for a long amount of time,
yep.
But it's worth it.
You're right.
Now, did you grow up in the backwoods country, or are you a city girl?
No, I'm a city girl. I'm from Garland, Texas, which is right near Dallas.
Right.
So
how did you decide then to go out, into the wilds, as they say?
Well, growing up, we always went on a lot of family vacations, and our biggest thing was never to go like see necessarily like the big sites that everybody goes sees, but we'll just go out and go hiking and see some of the wildlife. So I really was interested in that. I thought that was a really cool lifestyle to not have to be stuck on your phone and on the internet and just kind of get out there and see the nature.
Yep. So you're seeing it, smelling it, feeling it. It's it's a big difference than doing it virtually. So
yeah,
that's great. So I was in Kelly's shoes, I don't know, 25, 30 years ago as an undergrad. And my hope is that Kelly's she's the next generation of wildlife biologists. So, anybody out there listening, maybe will hire you soon.
Let's hope so, yeah.
Yeah. So I know you're looking for a summer internship. So
I am.
So maybe someone out there is listening that can hire or get some wildlife experience.
And you get to go back to all of your classmates and say, I got to go on the radio. What did
I
you
know.
Get to do? I got to shovel manure.
Yeah.
I grew up in farm country. I know that one. So give us a call at 800-552-8502. You are listening to Bird Calls, and we'd love to have your calls tonight about our avian world. And we have a wonderful show coming up. Right now, we're going to go to this month's Spotlight Bird. Can you tell us what we got this
month? Yeah, we profile a different species every episode. And this time, I've picked one of my favorites, the barred owl. So not to be confused with the barn owl. The barred owl, let me spell that, B-A-R-R-E-D, is named for the barring or streaking across much of the bird's undersides. They're often very loud when hooting, as heard here. Who cooks for you? Who cooks for you all? Let's hear it again. Here it comes. Wait for it. Great. So that's the barred owl. We're going to hear another one in just a second, but they'll play with that who cooks for you, who cooks for you all. You'll hear all kinds of variations. Sometimes you'll just hear the, oh, or the you all. You'll hear the, wah, 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 and all kinds of variations. But what's really neat is a loud scream they do. We're going to play it here in a second, but this is the call that most people don't know what it is. And if they're camping in the woods, they think it's some little old lady that's getting attacked, and they pack up their camping gear and they go home. So let's hear that, Bill. Here, Bill's going to fire it up.
A much louder one.
And there's the hoots. So that scream is part of the repertoire of the barred owl. Not many people get to hear it, but if you do, it's not Bigfoot. It's not someone getting attacked. That's just one of the different call notes of the barred owl, and it's rarely heard, but when it is, it'll make the hair on the back of your neck go up. I have to agree, it's pretty scary sounding. But this is a large grayish-brown owl. It's roughly the size of an NFL football, has dark eyes and no ear tufts. The species is a year-round resident. It's non-migratory. It occurs typically in low-lying areas like swamps or bottomland hardwood forests near creeks, rivers, and lakes. They eat a variety of prey, including large invertebrates and small vertebrates. So some of their favorites include eating crawfish, yum, snakes, frogs, birds, and rodents. This owl is pretty small-footed, so they rarely eat anything squirrel-sized or larger. So this isn't an owl you need to worry about with your dog or your cat. Like in most owls, the female of the barred owl is about 10 to 15% larger than the male, yet his hoots are deeper than hers. And to see a photo of a barred owl by James Childress of Lufkin, you can go to the Bird Calls page on the Red River Radio site and see a picture of a barred owl.
And I have to confess, the first time I had ever heard of the barred owl, I was literally seeing an image of a Shakespearean-type owl, you know, with the wig on and the little glasses, you know, something that you'd see in the comic characters.
Yep.
So. Well, give us a call, folks, at 800-552-8502. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, who is with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, where he is their statewide non-game ornithologist. We'd love to hear your calls tonight. All lines are open. The number, again, is 800-552-8502. And yesterday, we actually received a recording from Gary Hunter, who called in or sent this in from Lufkin, Texas. He had recorded this literally Sunday night, and this was outside of his home there in Lufkin, and he kind of wanted to know what he was hearing. There's a whole symphony of sounds here, so we're going to take a listen to rather a long section of this, and then we'll have Cliff explain what we're hearing. Now, I got to confess, when I heard that squawking sound, I thought it was almost like what you would hear those wild turkey fake squawkers that you get,
The box call.
Right.
It does. It sounds like the yelp of a wild turkey, but this was at 7:30 p.m. in the city limits of Lufkin. And so, when it came to me, I knew what it was. I knew these weren't birds. I'm fortunate in my office to work with a few herpetologists, so I gathered them up, Dan Sines, Corey Adams, and James Childress, the same James Childress that took the picture of the barred owl that I mentioned a minute ago. And so we all listened to this, and what was most confusing were those yelps. So these are gray tree frogs, and they're very bird-like. In fact, in the September 2014 episode of this show, we profiled several frogs that sound like birds. So you can go back to the podcast from September 2014 and hear the gray tree frog and the Rio Grande chirping frog that sound very bird-like. But these are gray tree frogs, and when they get into groups like this, they get into a kind of a calling frenzy, and that's what those those yelps are. Those are males that are just getting super jazzed up, and they're all trying to compete. You know, they're calling for females, and when there's several males like that, they're trying to outdo each other. And I think those that it was explained to me, these are just supercharged males that are just super excited. So gray tree frog is what that is, and that's a commonly heard species. You can hear them occasionally on cloudy days or rainy days up in the trees, and they do sound very bird-like. Mm-hmm. So it is important for bird people to learn a few of the frogs in their area because of these that sound like birds. Otherwise, you're going to hear that and say, what kind of bird is that? I'm going to go walk over there, and sounds like it's 20 feet up in the tree. I'm going to stand here until that bird flies. Well, you're going to be standing there for a long time, my friend, and because no bird's going to fly. It's a frog. So it's good to learn a few other sounds of nature. Another one is the gray squirrel, what we call the cat squirrel is a colloquial name. They can sound somewhat bird-like as well with their little bark that they do, or meow, because that's why they call it the cat squirrel. We probably ought to profile that in the future. I hadn't thought of that. There, so we'll go do the gray squirrel in a future episode.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have four lines open right now, and Walter is online from Marshall. Walter, you're online with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question tonight?
Do you ever encounter that panther while you're out after dark? He's got a scream like a woman, too.
Yeah, and the bobcat makes a scream, too, but, you know,
hair stand up on the back of your neck.
Yeah, I know it. There's a lot of sounds out there. And actually, that reminds me, Walter, maybe Bill will fire up later. We have some other night sounds that we're going to listen to later. But no, I've not encountered a mountain lion in East Texas. Actually, I haven't gotten one in the U.S., and I haven't seen my first one in my life until almost a year ago today. I was in Argentina in early April of 2016 and saw my first mountain lion. So I had to go to another country to see one.
They're here,
yep.
Believe me. I've seen them getting the cows up at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Uh-huh.
And with a flashlight, and I said, what a funny tail that dog has, and it wasn't a tail.
Yeah.
This is about the size of a regular dog.
Right.
You know, they're all... Have you ever heard the Veil of Ignorance?
Yes, sir.
Okay. When they're all telepathic but us.
Oh.
God gives us the veil so we won't be scared to death.
Okay.
When we see everything that he sees.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. The Veil of Ignorance keeps you, your conscious mind, your subconscious mind, from being simultaneously used.
Okay.
You put them together and you judge yourself.
Yeah.
But I appreciate you all doing a great job.
Thank you, Walter.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. And I have a question, Cliff. Do coyotes also make kind of a screech like a young girl almost crying?
I've never heard it. They're very dog-like. And so whatever you can imagine a dog doing, I think you're going to be pretty spot on for a coyote. But I don't know if you've had a minute to pull up the other sound. Do we have time to get
to that? The chirping frog?
No. The other mammal that I sent you. Do we have that?
Which one would that be?
Well, I don't want to give it away.
Well, then
maybe we don't have
it. I'm kind of lost here.
Okay.
Because I put up all the birds.
Okay. We'll save it for another episode, and I don't want to say what it is because it'll give away the punchline. So let's just move on to the next caller.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we got another caller online, and if Wally could type a little faster, I'd get it here, but we're just going to go to this caller. Go ahead, caller. What's your name?
Ina.
Hi, Ina. And where are you from?
I'm from West Louisiana, about halfway up.
Okay.
The Southern River. And I want to know the laws considering who can trap, poison, shoot. I would say I wouldn't do any of it, but the owl species of different kinds, if you have a wooded area like I do and the hunters want to shoot at everything sometimes.
Yeah, well, they can't shoot at everything. That's why we have legal game limits or game species with bag limits, and none of the owls are acceptable.
So if somebody's shooting an owl, that's totally illegal.
It's always illegal. There's never an exception on that. So Yep, and all the species of owls. We have something called the Migratory Bird Treaty Act from 1918, and it protects all of our native species, and that includes all of our owls. So there are federal and state laws, in addition to that, protecting our owls. So, and we want to have owls. They're good neighbors to have. Mm-hmm. Think about it. They're eating rodents most of the time. And if we didn't have owls, if we didn't have hawks, if we didn't have snakes, all these things that eat rodents, we would be overrun with rodents.
Well, I'm a fan of them all.
Yep. So we shouldn't kill all the snakes. We shouldn't kill any of the, you know, really any of the snakes.
Oh, I handle snakes. I'm a totally woods person.
And oh, good.
I don't believe in killing anything unless you're starving and want to eat it right now.
That's right. And you mentioned eating, and that's another thing, is we shouldn't shoot things that we're not going to eat.
Right.
So game species, and I'm thinking of birds. Everything is palatable if you're going to hunt waterfowl, any of the grouse or quail, turkey, pheasants, dove, etc. These are things you're not only going for the sport, but you're also going for the meat. And no one's going to eat an owl, so we need to quit the owl shooting. It's just nonsense.
Well, it's a fantastic bird, and the pileated woodpecker.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the laws on woodpeckers? Isn't it against the law to kill any of those
yes,
species?
Yes, same thing. Ditto with that one with what I said about owls. So, yep. Here, Bill's playing the call of the pileated. Let's listen.
Oh, yeah. I have a few on my property. They're fantastic.
Yep. They're a neat
great,
bird.
Great in the morning.
Oh, I love them. I love it all, though.
Yep. So, yeah, I think it's pretty clear. Hunters should study the books, no matter what state they're in, on what's in season, when you can do it, and how many you can bag. Because there's still, it never fails. We don't go 3 or 4 years before someone's shooting a whooping crane. And that's, you know, that's the worst of the worst, because we have so few of those left. But people that are thinking, you know, that I'm going to eradicate all the predators in my area and shoot all the hawks and owls, I hope they're overrun with rats. I'm sorry, because that's just wrong.
Well, everything has a place in this fabric of life, but
that's
we
right.
Don't need to be killing off species.
That's right, Ina. Well, thank you for your call.
Well, thank y'all for having the show.
Thanks.
You betcha. You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call tonight. We have all lines open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And for those who do like to hunt, if you really need to hunt something, there are plenty of wild hogs out there to hunt down.
That's right. That's right. You can do that one year-round. So.
And plus, they actually cook up pretty tasty. I've had a few roasted over an open fire.
Yeah, you can not only feed the family, but maybe the neighborhood.
Yeah, pretty much, or just stock up on meat for yourself.
Yeah,
so,
that's right.
And they are actually, as you say, when they come tearing through the backwoods, they literally tear it up.
Yeah.
They destroy habitat as they're foraging, grubbing, digging up the ground, digging up and destroying corn and crops. And they have very little respect for plant life.
That's right. They're a tiller. You know, that's what their job is to do, is till. And you got to think, if they're in the woods where everything's in a natural state, they're tilling next generation of plants.
Yeah.
And they're not only eating eggs, like I mentioned, they're crushing and eating future habitat. So,
you are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. Give us a call tonight, 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Mike from Hallsville, you're online with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
My question is that I read somewhere that birds that migrate, they process like the electromagnetic, what is that called?
Field?
Yes, sir. They process that like we process dish. Is that correct, or am I mistaken?
Well, they use it like an internal GPS. Is that what you're talking about? Orienting themselves? Yeah, and so they're also, not only that, but they're using at night the stars for like a map. So there are a lot of tricks that these birds are using that we have to use gadgets to do the same thing, which is pretty impressive. And some of these warblers weigh the same as 3 coins in your pocket. and yet they're equipped with these methods of getting, you know, if you're a black pole warbler, you're going to winter in South America, and you're going to then fly all the way to the northern boreal forests of Canada, and then back again. And it's an elaborate migration, the black pole warbler, and it never gets on an airplane like we do it, and doesn't use a GPS or Google Maps like we do. It's just remarkable.
Yes.
All right, Mike.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we're going to go next to Janine from Lufkin. Janine, you are on the line. What's your question?
Well, I don't really have a question, but I just want to say I love your show.
Great.
We have a neighbor that they regularly hay their fields. And for some number of years, they had a problem with crayfish mounds.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where he got the idea, but it worked. And they built these really tall poles with perches on the top. And they had these hawks that would come in and set up on the perches, and they hunted that field clear of crayfish.
Wow. Those are probably red-shouldered hawks. They are in this area, and they're in a big chunk of the southeast, and they love crawfish. I mean, who doesn't?
Right.
You know, that's my favorite time. This is my favorite time of the year when crawfish are in season and, what, $5 a pound, cooked and ready to eat. That'd be the red-shouldered hawk. You'll also see yellow-crowned night herons. They'll feed in these fields that might have a little or even no water, but crawfish chimneys, and they'll feast on them too. But the barred owl's doing it at night. So I bet barred owls could have been sitting on this post. You just didn't know it because it was pitch dark.
Yeah, we have a lot of those around here too. And the hawks, they're resident families.
Uh-huh.
They're always here. But, if somebody's having a problem with crayfish in their hay fields, you know, build those perches because they work. So.
Oh, that's cool. And that's biological control. That means you're not dumping pesticides and other harmful chemicals. You're just kind of luring in, you know, what is wanting to eat these things. So I like that. I wonder if the pole's big enough for me to sit on, because I really like eating crawfish. You think it'll hold me?
It possibly could. So.
Isn't that a Guinness thing?
Yep.
Thank you.
Give us a call at 800-552-8502 if you'd like to be on Bird Calls tonight. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist, and he is the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We thank them for loaning him to us. And Cliff, you have something to say there?
And I wanted to make a shout out to callers that if you have a question for our on-air guest, Kelly, you know, she's a college student. If you have a question about what's it like going to college and studying wildlife, Kelly's here, and she can field those questions. What do you think,
Absolutely.
Kelly?
Absolutely.
Maybe
yeah.
we can get
have
some young high school students to give us a call about the potentials
That's
in
right.
that particular yeah. field. So give us a call. Again, the number is 800-552-8502. We're going to go to Robert next from Baton Rouge. Robert, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Hey, I just want you guys to know I'm enjoying the show tremendously. I'm an environmental engineer. I'm actually driving back from a job site up kind of between Natchez and Vicksburg. I'm on my way back to Natchez right now listening to your show. I was fascinated by the sound of the red fox, which I've heard not only in my neighborhood in Baton Rouge, well within the city limits, but also in downtown Bay St. Louis.
Yeah.
And the first time I heard it, it was a very disturbing sound because it sounded like a woman in distress.
Yep, yep. And disturbing is the best word to describe it, Robert. I agree. And you kind of stole our punchline when I said a few minutes ago we're going to profile something different. It's the red fox, because that critter, as you pointed out, makes some really wicked sounds. And
well,
so,
I hope you guys find that tape, because I'm sure all you listeners would love to hear that.
Yeah, and I sent it in, but we don't have it at our fingertips right now. And to be fair, this is a bird show, but the reason I like to play these night sounds is because a lot of people think they're birds.
Yeah.
And so a lot of those night sounds come to me as the bird person at Parks and Wildlife, and a lot of the times I'm like, nope, that's a herp, nope, that's a mammal. So I have to know a little bit of everything, or at least know who to go to. That's the good thing about being a biologist for a long time. I know who the friend is to phone, you know, kind of a lifeline where I can phone a friend and say, hey, I know this isn't a bird. What is it? And then I learn. And I think that's the beauty of this field. And Kelly's got, you know, years and years to realize that you don't pick this stuff up overnight. You don't pick this stuff up in a class or in the summer. You pick it up over a lifetime. And I think that's what the beauty is of this field, is that you can spend 80 years doing this and you still learn something new every day. So Kelly, just remember that.
I agree wholeheartedly.
Yep.
As an engineer, I've worked with so many people that they're so disconnected from the reality of what you see in the field.
Right.
And it's imperative. In fact, I do have a Kelly question.
Yay!
I'd like her to share with the listeners what does she want to do with her career? Because I think that would be kind of an interesting topic.
Great question.
So much she could do with it.
Yeah.
And I'd like to sign off by saying, yeah, I agree with you that my question was a little off topic and I was a little hesitant to bring it up.
That's okay.
But thanks for fielding it. I'm going to go ahead and sign off so I can listen to the radio show. But Kelly, I'd love to hear your feedback on what you'd like to do career-wise, and share with you that even though I'm an environmental engineer, and yes, what I do is design and clean up environmental mishaps of our society, and there is a gamut of career opportunities for the wildlife biologist.
Mm-hmm.
And you might want to consider pursuing that as a career opportunity.
Are you offering her a job?
Yeah, seriously.
I'm not, but...
well, let's let her graduate first, and then she'll be ready. But that's a great question, Robert, so let's see, hear what Kelly has to say.
Thanks for calling, Robert.
Looking forward to it. Thank you.
Well, my main goal is really just to help with the conservation effort going on in America, but I'm looking at being like a wildlife biologist, anywhere from that, or like a wildlife rehabilitator, anything that will really help keep the population sustained and growing.
Great answer. I mean, I'd hire her. Jeez, that's the right answer.
As a pet rescue person here, I've adopted 3 dogs over my life from pet rescue. I can hats off to you on that. So you are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Most of our lines are open, but we have one are closed right now, but we have one open. And we're going to go next to Brandon from Shreveport. Jim and Joshua and Diane, you are on the line. Please hang on. Brandon, what's your question tonight?
Hey, everybody. I'm just wondering if there's been any study into the melody of bird songs in a musical sense.
Oh, my wife and I bought a CD. I wish I could remember it. It was a banjo player. It was a stringed instrument, and every song was named for a bird and used the melody from that bird. But yeah, I think that question is going to be better for a musician than an ornithologist. So I'm not going to be able to help you, except for this one. I cannot remember the name of it. But
what would be a way of identifying, of kind of researching how to identify a bird by its call? Is there any resource for that?
Yeah, there are lots of CDs out there that help. There's a lot of websites. You know, that's something that wasn't available when I was starting to learn this.
The Cornell site is absolutely fabulous for bird songs. Yeah.
Yep, Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Just look for the Macaulay Library of Sounds, and they have a lot of good stuff that's available for free on the web. And the technology is coming. Actually, there is a new app out that will help you identify a bird by sound. And so it records it. It's not 100% accurate, but it can say, well, it might be this, this, or this. And if it can narrow it down to 3 or 4 species, hey, that's already, you've already almost won the game, because if you open up your book and you don't know any birds, there's 500 species in that book. You've already narrowed it down. So the technology is coming. It's not perfected. I've seen this write-ups on this this new app that does the sounds. There's also another app that helps you identify birds by sight, where it asks you some really broad questions, broad-based questions of what does the bill look like, and where are you, and what's the season, and they've got these you know, this computer that's crunching through and saying, okay, it's March 28th. Okay, they're in Lafayette. Okay, and they said the beak's like this. And then all of a sudden, boom, here's three or four choices. And it might not be right all the time, but it's helpful. I think those technologies are going to be perfected. And, you know, my kids that are young, they're probably going to have something like that not in the distant future, and it's going to be pretty cool. Although, you know, there's something to say about figuring things out mm-hmm. on your own. You know, gone are the days of people learning how to read a map, and I'm talking a paper map. So I don't know, there's part of me wants to have the old school way of, you know, trying to figure it out, but then maybe you just ought to quiz yourself, figure it out, and then have the app to give you the final answer, maybe. So yeah, so Brandon, there are a lot of things out there on the web, and look for some of these apps for your cell phone.
Awesome. Well, we'll do. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks, Brandon.
All right, thank you, Brandon. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. We have Diane, Gary, and Joshua on hold right now, but Jim from Boyce, you're up next. Jim, what's your question?
Good evening, gentlemen and Kelly. I enjoy feeding birds and observing them in my yard. I live in the country. I'm having a real difficult time finding anything to attract crows. Do you have any suggestions?
Attracting crows?
Yeah, I love crows. I've always been fascinated by them. They're around, but I just can't get them to come into the yard and feed out of any of my feeders.
Well, if you've got about 40 years to spare, I'd plant a big grove of pecan trees, and then you got to wait about 40 years, or not really 40, but pecan trees, they will hammer those when they start producing.
Actually, I live right in the middle of a pecan grove.
Oh.
They're all around, but I can't get them to come in close.
You want them coming close. Well, how about putting those pecans on the bird feeder? Have you tried that?
I've tried that.
Yep.
That doesn't seem to work. I've even put cracked pecans out. That doesn't seem to work.
And you mentioned you're out in the country. I find that birds that aren't as used to people are that way for a reason. And so country birds are often a lot more skittish than city birds. So crow's a good example. You know, you can walk fairly close to a crow that's in garbage in the city, but out in the country, man, I think they get harassed and shot at and pestered, that they, if they're not wary, they're dead. So I think that might be the issue, is you might need to move to an urban setting and maybe get your urban crow to come in.
No, I wouldn't.
I wouldn't either. I'd stay in the country.
I think I'll stick with the wily country crow.
Yeah, I think so too. Maybe a good spotting scope, you know, put your feeder out 150 yards from the house and set that spotting scope on it, and maybe that'll work. So they're just skittish for a reason.
Okay.
Yep. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Jim. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. We're going to go next to Joshua from Longview. But Tony, Gary, and Diane, please stay on the line. You're on hold now. Tony, what's your question? I'm sorry, Joshua. What's your question? My bad.
It's all right. My grandmother loves hummingbirds. She has feeders all over her backyard, just loves seeing them everywhere, and she kind of got me to just appreciate them, yet I can't ever seem to have any come and visit my hummingbird feeders. Do you have any suggestions for that?
It's tough. So what we recommend is not only putting up a feeder, but putting up a wildscape in your yard, and that means landscaping for wildlife. That means planting nectar-giving plants that are native. So some of the best ones for hummingbirds are going to be Turk's cap, lantana is a really good one. Some of the tubular vines, like cross vine, is a really good one. So that's what I would recommend. And not only do they give nectar, they're also bright and colorful, which is the neon sign to attract hummingbirds and other nectar feeding plant critters, like butterflies, for example. So it's not just the feeder. So think about it. If you just put up, you know, one garage sale sign and expected everybody to see it, it's tough. But if you put up a whole bunch, you got a better shot selling your stuff at your garage sale. So it's kind of the same idea with the attracting birds to your backyard. If you want something that's after a lot of color and a lot of nectar, give it to them. So look up Wildscape under our Texas Parks and Wildlife website. We have a lot of tips and ideas of how to bring wildlife to you. Okay?
Oh, well, thank you.
Yep, very good.
That's what I was needing. I appreciate it.
Yep, thank you, Joshua.
Right. Thank you, Joshua. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We're going to go to Diane next, and Gary and Tony, you're still online. Diane, what's your question tonight?
Yes, what is a good economical way to keep the birds out of my blueberry bushes?
Out of your blueberry bushes?
Out of my blueberry bushes.
You like those blueberries, huh?
I love them. Can you blame her?
And we didn't get where you're from, Diane. Where are you from?
I'm from Stanley.
Okay, I don't even know where that is. Where is that?
It's between Mansfield and Logansport.
Okay, very good. Well, yeah, what I've seen people do with blueberries is just plant a whole bunch of them, and that way you're happy with blueberries and so are the birds. You have to do netting. Netting is going to be the only way to keep the birds out. So if you have a big grove, though, you know, people think, oh, hundreds of these birds are going to come in and strip the bushes, but that's not usually the case. By the time blueberries come out, which is, you know, what, third week of June, is that about when they come out?
That's about when, uh-huh.
Yep, and here I am, the bird guy, already talking about blueberries. And that's because my family of four, we are blueberry fanatics. So what we've done, we've gone to those pick-your-own places, and I'm fascinated with the birds that are in the blueberry patch. So I'm picking, of course, and eating as I go. But I'm also looking at the pileated woodpecker that's hanging upside down, three feet above the ground, eating as well. Well, some people say, well, then we're going to be overrun with pileated woodpeckers. Well, remember, he is territorial, and he's not going to let another pileated woodpecker in there. But over to the next bush, there might be a gray catbird. And over the next bush, there might be a painted bunting. So I think there's just going to be onesies and twosies, or let's say pairs of these berry-loving birds in there. But you're not going to have hundreds and hundreds of these critters eating up your berries. I think if you can plant enough bushes and have enough for everybody, everybody's happy, because that's a lot cheaper than putting nets up.
Yeah, someone told me snakes, and I got some rubber snakes.
It doesn't work. No, okay. Those berries are too alluring, and they'll look at that snake, and after about 2 minutes, they'll say, nah, he's not moved. I'm moving in. And owl decoy, same thing. That owl decoy isn't moving. They're going to figure it out. Next thing you know, that bird's going to be eating a blueberry on top of that, while perched on top of that owl decoy. So I wouldn't waste your money. I would plant more blueberry plants and have fun with it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Diane.
Bye-bye.
That's right out of a Warner Brothers cartoon.
Yeah.
Give us a call, 800-552-8502. You are listening to Bird Calls, and we have lines open now. Gary from Lufkin, you're up next. What's your question?
Hey, Cliff, this is Gary in Lufkin, and I thank you for solving my recorded mystery earlier.
Oh, good.
And I guess I'm actually following up a bit on Joshua's question. During a February bird walk, you mentioned an early flowering plant that helps sustain hummingbirds during the early part of the season, like early spring, maybe even late winter.
Yeah.
And I'm curious if you could tell me what that plant was.
Well, so I probably mentioned the buckeye, and that's a plant that usually flowers around the middle of March, and that's when our first ruby throats start to return.
Okay.
So a buckeye is a good plant to have. It's got a fairly small red tubular flower. We've got some in our yard that are monstrous. They're 7 foot tall, but they don't have to be. They can be, you know, first year, small little guys that have flowers, and that's a nectar source for ruby-throated hummingbirds. Yep, so Turk's cap is one that blooms really late. It doesn't start blooming until it gets pretty hot in the end of May, but they stay blooming in the fall and winter, and they'll get up to Christmas if we don't have a freeze. And so the reason I'm talking about that is you want to also think about having flowering plants year-round, because depending on where you are, your latitude, you could be really mild and you could be hosting wintering hummingbirds. And your feeder is a good thing to have out in the winter for that, but also to have some of these plants we're mentioning, some Turk's cap that'll get them through the fall, and these buckeyes that will start blooming in March. But there's a period, you know, after the freeze and into January, February, where there's really not a whole lot. So they would be very dependent on our hummingbird feeder. So I think that's the thing to remember, is that there's a myth that if you don't take your hummingbird feeder down at Halloween, they're going to stay with you all winter, and that's bad. They won't migrate. We don't have that control. Mm-hmm. And what we find are that a lot of the birds, hummingbirds that winter with us, didn't oversummer with us. These are birds that have showed up in the fall or winter, and it's good to have these nectar sources for them. So, but Gary, that recording you sent of the tree frog, those were fantastic. Did you just use a cell phone for that?
No, I actually used a, it's a Olympus kind of little portable handheld recorder.
Just the kind you would take to college class and record a lecture?
Well, you know what I actually use, as far as when I'm birding, I actually take it in the field with me and help notate what birds I've seen.
Great. Well, it was a good, great quality recording of those tree frogs. So thanks for sending that in.
Send us some more if you get some out there that you don't know.
Good deal, and thanks for your help.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. I have Reginald on hold as well as Kelly, but we're going to go next to Tony, who was driving through. Tony, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
All right, how about that? And what is your question tonight?
Well, I was wondering, I heard you mention the cranes, the whooping cranes, and I was wondering if they're still around or if there's any spots to see them in southern Louisiana while I'm down here.
Well, there is an introduced population, maybe 40, 45 birds in the White Lake area, not far from Lafayette, and they're supposed to be there year-round. What's happening, though, is a lot of those birds, and they're banded, so we know this, and some of them have satellite backpacks, and we know where they're going, or at least Louisiana does. Some of those birds are going due west and ending up in my state, in Texas, during the hot summer months, and it's crazy to have a whooping crane in Texas in the hot summer months, because we have the native flock that's been around for millennia that go from Aransas National Wildlife Refuge on the Central Coast and go up to the Wood Buffalo area in Canada. And those birds are usually gone by this time of the year. So it gets to be tough to find one after the middle of March. And then the tours start up about, I think, November 1 to March 1, I think, is the going rate for boat tours in the Aransas area in central Texas. But we have had over-summering birds on the central coast, and the belief is that these are older individuals that just can't make it anymore. They might be 25, 35 years old, I don't know, but they're long-lived birds, and you know, there probably comes a point when you're like, I love Canada, but I just can't make it. But let me tell you, where these guys are going to Canada, it's beautiful, it's cooler. You know, we're suffering here in Texas and Louisiana this summer, and those birds are smart going up there, where you gotta, if you were you and me, we'd be wearing jackets at night. And these birds, of course, are equipped with feathers. That's their built-in down jacket. But so to get back to your question, look for the White Lake area, and I don't know what the public accessibility is for seeing them at that spot, but it's something for you to look into, and good luck seeing one of those birds. They're pretty neat.
Are there spoonbills in southern Louisiana, or am I way out of range?
No, there are roseate spoonbills. The closer you get to the coast, the better. So this time of the year. So later on in the hot summer and into the fall, they will wander inland. But this time of the year, they're going to be really hugging the coast and near the coast, because that's where the breeding colonies are. So that one you'll have to drive, you know, down farther south of Lafayette to find roseate spoonbills. So in my part of the state, you would want to get towards, well, a great spot is in High Island. There's a nesting colony on one of the Houston Audubon sanctuaries called Smith Oaks Rookery, and you're within a stone's throw of roseate spoonbills on the nest. And right now they're laying eggs. If you go in about 4 weeks from now, you'll see these fuzzy, funny-looking babies with these big spatulate bills, and they're just really crazy-looking, and I just can't get enough of going to that spot. So I'm sure there's other...
What's that called? The Smith what?
It's called the Smith Oaks Rookery. It's in High Island, Texas, which is in far western Galveston... I'm sorry, eastern Galveston County. So this is east of Galveston Bay. So for anybody in Louisiana, it's not even an hour, maybe an hour into Texas. And this is publicly accessible. It costs a few bucks to get in. And the beauty is the nest is a stone's throw away. There's a moat. It's on a wetland. So it's think of a moat connecting or keeping you from being connected to where they're nesting on this little island. And it's just fantastic. It's covered in bird watchers and nature photographers, because there's nothing cooler than great egrets and roseate spoonbills and cattle egrets all nesting together. And there's some tricolors nesting in there, and little blues and neotropic cormorants. And it's just really neat to see all these birds breeding communally at such close range to you.
Well, thank you very much.
Yep. All Thanks right. for the call, Tony.
Thank you. And you are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We've got two more callers online and lines open right now. We're going to go next to Reginald from Cotton Valley. And Kelly, please hang on. We'll be with you in just a moment. Reginald, what's your question?
Hey, good evening. I'm tuned in for the first time, and I've got a question for you, and I'll get off the line so you can answer it.
Okay.
For a couple of years, we've noticed we purchased about 12 acres of land out here in Cotton Valley. Me and my family did, and for a couple of years, sometime between the spring and summer, there's a whole flock of birds. I want to say thousands that migrates in.
Uh-huh.
They're not very large in size, but my goodness, there's a whole flock. When we open the windows in the morning, we look at the ground or at the grass, it's covered. You cannot even see the grass.
Are they dark?
They're dark in color.
Uh-huh.
And they move in unison.
Yep.
Wherever they go. And they'll come down and they'll get in the grass. I don't know what they're eating or what they're hunting. And I'm kind of curious as to what kind of birds they are, and what is it that they're actually eating when they cover up the ground like that, perch up in the trees, and
right.
And I'll go ahead and let you answer.
Okay.
Those questions.
Okay. Thanks, Reginald. Yeah, the one bird that comes to mind, there's several birds that get in big groups like that are all dark, but I'm betting that Reginald has common grackles.
Hmm.
And they get in immense groups. They feed on the ground. They're looking for insects. They're also, this time of the year, they're looking for old acorns even. They'll eat those that have been buried and still have a little value to them. But common grackle is what I'm guessing he has. And they're in these big groups that he mentioned. Yep.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have time for one more. Kelly from Alexandria, you're our final call tonight. And what's your question?
Regarding hummingbird feeders, do you have a recipe to make the homemade solution as opposed to buying the solution in the store?
Yeah, I don't like recommending the pre-made stuff, especially those that have the food coloring. The food coloring is not part of the hummingbird's natural diet, so why should we supplement it? You want the red to be part of the feeder, or a red bandana or string or something that you tie near there, because that's the neon light like the flower does when it's colored red or yellow or orange. It's basically very showy, saying, hey, I've got something for you. So I like just brewing it myself. It's four parts water to one part sugar, and I like to heat it up. You can bring it to a boil or near boil, but definitely don't feed it until it's cooled off to room temperature. So that means you're going to make it and use it the next day is the best thing to do. And I make it in pretty good batches, and you can store it in the fridge. My wife and I brew it, and then we fill the feeder. Actually, to give her credit, my wife does most of the hummingbird work. I just stare at the birds out the window, and she's back in the background, you know, brewing them up. And it's like making iced tea and then putting in the fridge. And then when the feeder goes low, she refills it. But one thing we don't do is fill the feeder to the top. I think that's this time of the year, you don't need to do that. Maybe in the fall, which would be September, you would fill it to the top because you're going to have a lot of southbound migrants. But this time of the year, we don't have as many birds, and that stuff will spoil after a few days. So instead of saying, I'm going to keep it filled and top filled, and I'm not going to replace it until the hummingbirds eat it all, well, instead just fill it halfway, and after 4 or 5 days, replace it, maybe even 3 or 4 days when it's hotter in the summer. So 4 parts water, 1 part sugar, and that should be good. How's that sound?
Perfect. Thank you.
All right, Kelly. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Kelly. And you are listening to Bird Calls. And as we do at the end of our program, we're going to go to our conservation moment here with Cliff. And what do you have for us this month?
Well, this month we're going to talk about licensed wildlife rehabilitators. So it's important to have certain contact numbers easily accessible for you and your family. Keeping emergency contact numbers stored in your cell phone and in a central location, such as attached to your refrigerator, is always a good idea. These would be phone numbers for your local sheriff's office and your doctors, but what about your nearest licensed rehabilitator? These are the experts you need when you find an injured bird or other wildlife. They're trained and licensed with both state and federal permits. And be careful, however, when determining that that fledgling blue jay or deer fawn is orphaned, when in fact their parents might be cautiously watching nearby. Instead, let the parents finish raising their own young. Keep in mind that rehabbers are not government employees, so don't call your local, state, or federal wildlife official, nor are these rehabbers funded by the government. So be sure to include a financial donation when you submit an injured animal or when you feel the need to help them out. To find your nearest rehabber, search for, quote, wildlife rehabilitators in the state of X, end quote, on your computer, and you should be steered to your state's wildlife agency website listing those folks who might be able to assist. Keep in mind that there are large chunks of the country without any local rehabbers, so a long drive might be in order, but don't expect the busy rehabbers to come all the way to you since they're already tending to other injured wildlife back home. Contact them and work something out, but do it quickly, as injured wildlife might not have long to live. This is precisely why it's good to find your nearest rehabber now, so that when you need them, they'll only be a click away. Do it for the birds.
All right. And Kelly, do you have any final words to say?
Thanks for having me on. Yeah. That was good.
That was fun. That's Kelly's good. Our first on-air guest. How about that? What
debut.
An honor.
There you go. So you have been listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio, and I want to thank both Kelly and Cliff for coming in tonight and joining me. And our producer for this show is myself, Bill Beckett, along with Cliff Shackelford. We had help tonight from Wally Derleth and Henry Edwards and Tim Schnell. The audio for tonight's program will be posted on our website in the next few hours, and then you can listen to the program again. You'll also be able to see the photos that we sent in and the audio samples as well. And remember, if you have a photo or sound that you would like to send to Cliff, you can send it to my email address during regular business hours at wbeckett@lsus.edu. That's wbeckett@lsus.edu. Stay tuned. Radio Lab is coming up next here on Red River Radio.